Okay, well, we'll be heading into chapter 21 tonight in the 22nd class. That throws me that our class is one class off and from the chapter. As we head into Jerusalem here, Paul is finishing up his voluntary journeys, I guess you could say. The next journey he takes will not be of his own choosing. It will be under prison guard. But as he finishes that up, we are entering a section that is really remarkable when you think about it, because of the fact that the way God works to spread his gospel is nothing like how you and I would do it. It is going to be spread to the ends of the earth by a prisoner. Essentially, what we find is that God, instead of sending out the brass band, instead of sending out the fireworks and all these different things to announce to the world that they should become Christians, he sends out a man in chains, and it's going to work. And that humble presence of Paul as he leaves Jerusalem, as we see things as he comes into Jerusalem and the series of events that will come together to eventually lead him to Rome are really something when you think about how God took such an odd circumstance and caused it to be something that came together for so much good. And when you put that in perspective of your own life, you just realize, man, you have no idea what things will happen in your life that are different than what you expected but are exactly the right things to happen. And so, as we've been traveling through with Paul, we started out with that journey with Paul and Barnabas, that kind of first foray out to see the Gentiles and to preach and to set up congregations, and that went very, very well. But then after that journey, they decide to go back, but Paul and Barnabas fight over John Mark, whether to bring him or not, and Barnabas ends up going one way with John Mark, and Paul ends up taking Silas with him, and they take that second journey. And travel farther all the way through Greece and Corinth and all these different areas, much farther than previously. And then we've seen a third journey here, Paul's benevolent journey, which we'll wrap up tonight in chapter 21, where Paul has been sent out, and he has two goals. One, to reinforce the congregations that he's been to before, to preach the word there and to give them the truth, to set up new congregations in places like Ephesus. And then to gather and get the congregations to collect up funds to take care of the needy Christians in Jerusalem. And so as Paul has traveled out, he's been preaching to them, lay by in store on the first day of the week, and then when I come by, whoever you choose to send with the money can carry your gift down to take care of those Christians in Judea. And so tonight, Paul will arrive with that large group of people that went with him in Jerusalem after having collected all of those funds. So we'll go through the whole journey here because that repetition's huge. I know no other way to do it. There are certain things that the only way you get to learn it is through repetition. This is kind of like the ABCs. You try and teach a kid the ABCs. The only way to do it is to sing a little song over and over and over again until they get it. These journeys are the same way. We go through the repetition of it. We cover it a couple of times for each journey, and the map begins to kind of sink into your head. I know that that is the way with me and probably the case for many others. So Paul, as he left on this journey, he left Antioch, and then he travels through those churches in Galatia and Phrygia. He travels through Antioch and Iconium and Derbe and Lystra, all those congregations that were set up during the time that he went out with Barnabas. Then from there, he'll continue preaching in different congregations and telling them to take up a collection for the saints that are needy. He'll go to Ephesus, and from Ephesus, that's where he set up in that school for two years and preached and preached and preached and preached so that all Asia heard the word. First time Paul wanted to go down to Ephesus, the Holy Spirit told him no, and Paul was kind of upset about the whole thing. And now we kind of find out why. The timing was wrong. It wasn't that the Lord didn't want Ephesus to hear the gospel. It was, Paul, I have a certain time when I want you to be there. And that timing was just right so that he ends up spending 2 years there in Ephesus. And it says that all of Asia heard the word because of it. And so here's Paul. He's there for that length of time, but while he's there, a couple of things happen that are important for us to note. Over in Corinth, the Corinthians write him a letter, and it says, we've got problems. We've got questions. If a man's married, does he have to stay married? Can he divorce his wife for any old reason? Was Jesus really raised from the dead? And Paul gets the letter and goes, oh man, when you say you've got problems, you got real big problems. We need to get this figured out. And then he finds out some people come from Corinth. And he says, do you know they're divided? They're not taking the Lord's Supper together. They're not waiting for one another. They're divided based off of philosophy. One says, I follow what Paul teaches, and another says, I follow what Peter teaches. Well, if you're Paul, what you begin to think is, well, wait a second, I'm not teaching anything different than Peter. So there's a definite problem there. And so Paul finds that out too. And so he sends Titus with the 1 Corinthian letter at that time when he's there in Ephesus. And he sends Timothy over the top to revisit all of the congregations, not just Corinth. He sends these two men because they're both very trusted men. And you'll see that later on in Paul's letters when Paul writes 1 and 2 Timothy. And Titus, he writes to these two men whom he trusted with the gospel. So he sends these men to do preaching when he must stay in Ephesus because he trusted them. But eventually, there's that Ephesian riot. Paul will leave Ephesus and he will travel all the way over visiting all of those congregations, and he'll end up in Corinth himself. But while making that journey to Corinth, he's going to find Titus. And that's when he'll write the 2 Corinthian letter, because Titus will tell him, they got the letter, I preached to them, I taught them, they repented, they changed, they listened to you, Paul. And Paul will be so just almost weak with relief over that news that he pens the 2 Corinthian letter, which has that tone of it of just, I'm so proud of you and you scared me so badly, kind of that like a mom finding her kid who's been lost in the grocery store, that kind of sense of panic and relief at the same time. That's really the 2 Corinthian letter. And he writes that on the way down there. Eventually he makes it down to Corinth, spends some time there in Corinth, and that is most likely when he wrote the book of Romans and the book of Galatians during that time. And as he wrote Romans and Galatians, he had never been to Rome. And it's important for us to remember that, is actually as he writes the Roman letter, he writes to them and he says, I hope to see you someday. I hope to come and visit you. Well, little does Paul know, the way he's going to visit them is in chains. So he'll get to Rome, but not the way he expected. And so he'll at one point tell the Romans, if the Lord wills, I'll visit you someday. Well, the Lord will, but not the way that Paul expected. And how many things in life come down to that, right? The Lord has His will, and it's perfect, but it's different than you and I planned. And so Paul will write the letter there, and then from Corinth, his plan is to head back, to make it to Jerusalem for Pentecost. And so the fastest way to make it back is to go, well, just to go by sea. But as he plans to take a boat back down to Jerusalem, he finds out there's a plot against his life, so he can't go that route. So instead, what Paul will end up doing is he'll travel back on land. He'll travel back through the different congregations and back north and by land as opposed to by sea, that sea journey, because of that. And the reason most likely that that plot was there was not only just a desire to get rid of Paul, but you remember in the last chapter it mentions all of these people who are traveling with Paul. And the reason they're traveling with Paul is because these are the guys that the congregations are sending with their money, their gifts, to the needy brethren in Jerusalem. And so Paul has this entourage with him, and they all have a bunch of money. And so if you're going to mug somebody, you want to mug somebody with money, not a broke guy like me. And so that was the most likely the plan all along. And so here, as they leave, they travel back by land. They travel over the top. They visit Philippi. And actually, we didn't spend any time on it in chapter 20. But I'll make mention incidentally here, when we were in chapter 20, it says that when Paul left Philippi to go to Troas, he left after the days of unleavened bread. Now, the days of unleavened bread, that's another way of saying the Passover. What we're going to find is that Paul is in Philippi, which is, it's not technically on the map, but if you look at some of the other maps, it'll put it right about right there. He left Philippi on the Passover, and he'll get to Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. Well, this is really useful to us because these are two dates on the calendar, and that tells us how much time it took for Paul to make this journey. From Philippi to Jerusalem will be roughly 50 days because Passover to Pentecost is roughly 50 days. That's where the, if you even take the word Pentecost, penta, that idea, that five, that's why they called it that. It's a Greek word. It's 50 days after the Passover. So from Philippi, Paul will travel to Troas. That's where Eutychus falls out the window. That's where we see them taking the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. Then we see him traveling. His companions all travel by boat, and he walks on land to Assos. From Assos, travels to several different places, ends up in Miletus. That's where he visits with the Ephesian elders and tells them, I'm never going to see your face again. I most likely won't. And we find out that Paul knows something. Paul knows that he's going to Jerusalem and that he's going to be persecuted there. Something's going to happen to him there in Jerusalem. And we find out that everywhere he travels, there are prophets in those congregations telling him this. So every city that Paul goes to, every congregation, somebody stands up and says, Paul, you will be persecuted. If you go to Jerusalem, you'll be persecuted. So he says goodbye to the Ephesian elders there in Miletus. And in chapter 21, that's where we pick up. Does anybody have any questions so far on this particular journey? On any of the dating or the time or the locations or anything like that? Okay, so then Acts chapter 21, we pick up as Paul leaves by ship. And it says then in verse 21, it came to pass that when we, so you got that word we, so who's with Paul? At the very least, you know it's Luke. Luke's with him. And Luke is amongst many of those companions. It says, we had departed from them and set sail, running a straight course. We came to Kos, the following day to Rhodes, and from there to Patara. I'm not putting those locations on the map. When we had sighted Cyprus, Cyprus is that island right down here. It says, when we had sighted Cyprus, we passed it on the left, sailed to Syria, and landed at Tyre, for there the ship was to unload her cargo. So what we're going to find is that Paul will travel from Miletus, and his journey will look something like this. He's going to travel on this side of the island, travel down, he'll stop, the boat will dock here in Syria, but eventually he'll end up all the way down here. So I'm not putting all of those individual locations on there because they're more incidental locations. What I want you to get from all of these locations is instead of going this one, this one, this one, instead understanding the mapping. This is where he was traveling. This is the general journey. In the same way that somebody might tell you when, if you asked them where they've been, they say, oh, well, I went down 520 and then I hit I-5 over here. And well, all of that just gives you an idea of direction. That's what these cities are doing. They're giving you an idea of direction and how it was that he ended up getting down to Jerusalem. So the ship docks there, and it says in verse 4, finding disciples, that is partway through the journey. They're in Syria, close to the, right around here. It says, we stayed there 7 days. And they told Paul through the Spirit not to go up to Jerusalem. So we see that continued pattern. Paul, don't go. And when we come to the end of those days, we departed and went on our way. And they all accompanied us with wives and children till we were out of the city. And we knelt down on the shore and we prayed. And so you see this love. This is one of those things that is worth stopping for, but we often don't. Which is, as Paul went from place to place, in the same way with the Ephesian elders when they wept, when Paul said that he'd never see him again, and you see that tender affection there. Here Paul and his companions go to get back on the boat. They spent a week with these Christians here, who as far as we know do not have a individual tie to Paul. It just says they found some disciples there. There were some Christians. These Christians go down with them. They go to the boat. They bring their wives, they bring their children, they kneel on the beach, they pray there on the shore. Just an attitude of family love, isn't it? I mean, isn't that exactly the same way that it, well, I guess you can't do this so much now after 9/11, but that's the way I remember it was with the airport, right? When family members go off to the airport, what did everybody do? We'd all get in the car, we'd all go to the airport, we'd all stand there and kiss them and hug them and wave and watch their plane go by. That's the way that this is. It's that affection of family that you see in the brotherhood. And as much as we must emulate the behavior of the church in things like we worship when they did and we worship how they did and those sorts of things, we must also emulate their attitudes. I mean, that is an important key as well. And so having that idea of rejoicing with each other and weeping with each other and caring for one another is a big deal. So verse 6, it says, when we had taken our leave of one another, we boarded the ship and they returned home. And when we had finished our voyage from Tyre, we came to Ptolemais, greeted the brethren, and stayed with them one day. And on the next day, we who were Paul's companions departed and came to Caesarea and entered the house of Philip the evangelist, who was one of the seven, and stayed with him. Now pause there for just a second. You know this Philip. You remember all the way back in Acts chapter 6 when they chose seven men to take care of the feeding of the widows? One of those guys' names was Philip. He's the same Philip who ended up preaching to the Ethiopian eunuch. And he's the same Philip who was preaching in Samaria when Simon the magician was converted. That's this guy right here. And so we find in here he is referred to as Philip the evangelist. That is, the spreader of the good news really is the idea there. And this is one of those times where you see that word evangelist show up. There are different titles for preachers, and this is one of them, because Philip was just a normal, ordinary guy, but the one thing that he did was go out and spread the good news and to preach and to teach. And so here they stay at Philip's house, who was one of the seven, and it says, now this man had four virgin daughters who prophesied. And as we stayed many days, a certain prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. So we find that Philip, he has a family, he has daughters, his daughters are prophets, down in verse 10, we then read about another prophet named Agabus. And it says, he named Agabus, and he came down from Judea. Now, if you go back to Acts chapter 11, you've actually heard of Agabus before. You probably don't remember him. But in Acts chapter 11, down about verse 28, you will see that Agabus was the guy who prophesied there was going to be a great famine in all the earth. And so this whole collecting of funds to take care of the needy brethren, all of that began because Agabus was the guy that prophesied of that. Of course, it came to pass and all these things. But now Agabus shows up again. And he shows up, and it says, when he had come to us, he took Paul's belt, bound his own hands and feet, and said, thus says the Holy Spirit, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. So now we've seen this. This has been happening everywhere he goes. Paul will go and a prophet will tell him, Paul, there are going to be problems for you in Jerusalem. But now Agabus gets not only more specific, but more dramatic too, doesn't he? He takes Paul's belt, binds himself with it. It reminds me a lot of the Old Testament prophets. Old Testament prophets did a lot of this sort of stuff, visual aids. And so he binds himself and he says, the man who owns this belt, the Jews will bind him just like this. And we see something happen. Perhaps it was because they've been hearing this message so much. Perhaps it's because they were so close to Jerusalem. Perhaps it's because of the dramatic flair that Agabus had to offer. I don't know which. But something different happens this time. It says in verse 12, when we heard these things, both we and those from that place pleaded with him not to go up to Jerusalem. Now, up until this point, we have read about every city he goes, the people in the city, the Christians of that city, are worried for Paul. And they say, Paul, don't go. We're worried about you. Don't go. And we're sad. We'll never see you again. But something else happens here in verse 12. Not just the people of the city, not just the Christians from there, but it says we. Now, who's the we? Paul, when we have we, you got Luke in there. That's Paul's traveling companions. So now these guys who've been traveling back and forth with Paul, everywhere that Paul goes, they've been going with him. Finally, it's like they snap, they crumple, and they say, Paul, don't go. Just don't go, Paul. So now it's a different layer of pleading, isn't it? When you've got these guys who have just been his right-hand men. And so they begin to plead with Paul, and we're going to see that Paul is not a man immune to emotion. And that is another characteristic that we sometimes forget about with the Apostle Paul. We kind of think of him as the stalwart guy, the guy who'll courage that knows no bounds, but we've seen differently. We've seen that there have been times where he was scared, times where God had to tell him, be courageous, do not fear, keep preaching. So Paul is not as hardened a man as you and I might naturally assume. Acts really humanizes him when we begin to read it. And here in verse 13 is no exception. Paul answered, "What do you mean by weeping and breaking my heart? For I'm ready not only to be bound, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." So when he would not be persuaded, we ceased, saying, the will of the Lord be done. So you see here Paul, when his traveling companions break down, and all these people are saying, "Paul, don't go. Just don't go, Paul." And they're weeping. He says, "Why are you weeping?" I mean, this is not feigned in any way. This is a very real emotion. They are terrified for him. And if anybody had a reason to be terrified, it would be Paul's traveling companions. They knew what sort of troubles he could run into in places. They'd seen it. They'd seen him stoned. They'd seen him put on trial and thrown in jail. They'd seen all the things he'd been through. And when they crumple, Paul says, "You've got to stop weeping. You're breaking my heart." And you see that affection that he has for these men that have been traveling with him. And so when they realize, no, he's decided, they do the honorable thing and they say, "Well, the will of the Lord be done." That is, Paul, we're not going to try and make things harder on you. And of course, we've all probably been in situations like that where somebody's going to make a decision or do something that we would prefer them not to do. And eventually you back off and you say, "Well, I'll support you." And that's what they do. We'll support you. May the will of the Lord be done. And then it says in verse 15, "After those days we packed and we went up to Jerusalem." And with that, that ends Paul's third journey here, what we refer to as Paul's benevolent journey, because he's now at Jerusalem with all of those traveling companions, with all of that money that had been collected for the needy brethren. All of that has now come together. Does anybody have any questions on that journey at all? Yeah.
So if they said that he saw Cyprus on the left, does that go below it?
No, if you're, so as you're going, you have to think of them going towards it, it's going to be, did I mark it wrong on the map?
No.
I did. I marked it wrong on the map, didn't I? Yep, that's an oops on my part. It's the other one. It's going to go. It's going to go below it, and then they'll go back up. Let me double check just to make sure that is correct. Yes, they're going to go below it and then go back up. That's my fault. Yeah, so that's me getting the left and right messed up in my head there. So, yeah, it's from what I have read, there were several things that they mentioned in there that if you're somebody who does a lot of boating, it would be a big deal. Most of us don't sail, but they mentioned that came up that point towards it being very good weather. Like I think in one point in here, and I can't remember where it is, there's something indicated that they were traveling at night, which was a kind of a rare thing to not find a port at night, which indicates that there was it was fair weather. And then also, because they know when the Passover was and the Pentecost, we've got the dating really clear. They know that they were traveling during a time when the moon was pretty full, so that you had light. And so traveling that way, distance-wise, may be longer, but it's the weather would be fairer. So that I do remember reading about that and going, "Oh, that's interesting. The weather was... That's why they chose that, as it seemed the weather was fair. And if you're sailing and you've got good weather and you catch the winds right, it may be a longer distance, but it'd still be a shorter time." So, yeah, good catch. I just marked that wrong. Anybody else have any questions? Okay. So, then down in verse 16, it says, "Also some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us and brought with them a certain Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we were to lodge." So this Mnason, he was an early convert. And it says he's from Cyprus, but they were going to lodge with him. Most likely, this is a fairly wealthy man if he's from Cyprus, but but has a place to live in Jerusalem where all of these men can lodge. Jerusalem, it's like any other big city. If you own property in Seattle, it's expensive. If you own property or a house in Jerusalem, it's expensive. And so this probably was a wealthier brother who had a place for them to stay. And it says, "And when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly." Now this is a small verse. You wouldn't think much of it, except for this was not a given. And I want you to realize that when Paul went into Jerusalem with all of these Gentiles, because if you look at Paul's traveling companions, they're not Jewish, most of them. Most of them are Gentiles. And they bring this money from Gentile brethren. Paul was not sure that he would be received gladly or that the gift would be received gladly. If you look over in Romans chapter 15, when Paul wrote the Roman letter, wherein he was partway through this journey, chapter 15, and we'll start in verse 30. Paul wrote to the Roman brethren, he says, "I beg you, brethren, through the Lord Jesus Christ and through the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in prayers to God for me." So he asked them, "Please, brethren, pray for me, that I may be delivered from those in Judea who do not believe, and that my service for Jerusalem," that is the raising of the funds, "may be acceptable to the saints, that I may come to you with joy by the will of God and may be refreshed together with you." In verse 31 there of Romans 15, we find out that Paul was not sure that the brethren in Jerusalem would accept that money. And the reason is very simple. Paul is bringing money from Gentile Christians into a Jewish territory. Well, what historically have Jews felt about Gentiles? There's been a lot of animosity. Remember when Peter preached to Cornelius, he didn't even want to go to the guy's house. He didn't even want to be seen in public entering the house of a Gentile. That's how a guy like Peter, who was a good man, felt about Gentiles. No, I wouldn't be anywhere near those unclean people. So Paul's been out here setting up these congregations, and while he's been away, it's not like he's had email, right? It's not like he's had CNN telling him what's going on back with the Christians in Jerusalem. What's going on with the Jewish brethren? He has no idea. He does know that there certainly have been those who have been in the church who have been teaching you have to be circumcised, you have to be a Jew. A Gentile can become a Christian, but they've got to become a Jew first. He knows that false teaching's been out there because he's been dealing with it. But he has no idea how's the church going to be when I get there? Are they going to accept this as a gesture of love? Is there going to be this fellowship of character, of striving together? Are they going to accept the Gentile brethren? Or are they going to reject them and there's going to be this major problem within the brotherhood of prejudice? And that's what Paul was afraid of. And so he finds out here in Acts chapter 21, it says, "When he came to Jerusalem, the brethren received us," that's not just Paul, but us, that entourage, "gladly." That's a big statement. Because Paul had told the brethren, "Please pray that this goes well." And you can think about, it would be really no different than other times in the church. You know, you find where you have a brother or sister and they have some sort of animosity towards each other or frustration. Maybe they've had some sort of bitterness. And so you're going to have a meeting with them and you want them to just put it as water under the bridge. You want them to get along. I can tell you, I for one, whenever I've had to be involved with meetings like that, I just pray and I pray and I pray. God, just please let each of them see each other's heart. You know, don't let them get caught up in old prejudices. Don't let them get caught up in old pains. That's really what Paul is doing here. Paul loves the Jewish Christians, and he can see it from their perspective. They've had thousands of years of being told Gentiles are evil. And he loves the Gentile Christians because he's been involved in setting up those congregations, and he's seen and eaten with them and spent time with them. And so now their two worlds are colliding, and Paul has said, "Please pray with me that these walls can be torn down and there be no separation and that they would accept this gift from them." And in the end, that is exactly what happened, and that's a really wonderful thing. Anybody have any questions on that? Okay, so then everything from this point forward in this chapter is going to revolve around what happens at this location. This is a model. Actually, it looks really big on the picture here, but I think if you were to see it in person, it's like as big as this tabletop. You know, it's not that huge. But this is a model of what the Temple Mount looked like back in the time that Paul was around. And you have those big outer courtyards. That building in the center there, that is the temple structure itself. Only Jews were allowed in that temple area. They had markers set up all around in the courtyard saying that if a Gentile went into that temple area, they were to be put to death. It was very strict. No Gentiles were allowed into the temple. And then you have these outer porticos, these covered porches. That's actually where the early church met. When you read earlier on in the book of Acts about Solomon's porch and the church meeting there, that's where they met. Thousands of people could meet in those covered porches, which gives you a sense of the actual vastness of this structure. And so here, as Paul comes into Jerusalem, we're going to have some events happen. And they're all going to surround this area. And this is how it all begins. So in verse 18, it says, "On the following day, Paul went in with us to James." And all the elders were present. Now, verse 18, James, this is not the apostle James. That man had died. He'd been put to death by Herod. This is James, the brother of Jesus, his half-brother, I guess you would say. And he has become, we read in Acts chapter 15, he's amongst the eldership of the church in Jerusalem. He's a prominent member there in that congregation. He's well known, probably at least partially well known because of his relation to Jesus, but then also his faithfulness and his position as an elder. When the church had to make a decision and decide, what do we tell the Gentiles? Do they need to be circumcised or not? James was right there involved in that decision. In fact, he's the final voice that we hear speaking and saying, no, look at the evidence. They do not need to be circumcised to become Christians. And so Paul, he shows up, and they go, and James is there, and all of the elders from the church in Jerusalem are there as well. And it says, "And when he had greeted them, he told in detail those things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry." So Paul essentially recounts his journeys to them. And it says, "And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord. And they said to him, 'You see, brother, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law.'" So now what they're going to do, they glorify God. They're so impressed with what's happened with the Gentiles. But now they're going to tell Paul, "We have a problem. And it's a problem that we need to deal with right now. You, Paul, have a reputation. And we need to deal with that. Here in this city, we have myriads of Jews that there are here who have believed. That is, Jewish Christians. And they're all zealous for the law." Now, this is hard for us to understand, but if you are a Jew and you're converted to Christ, most of the Jews kept doing a lot of the Jewish things. Now, they wouldn't keep, they would no longer make the sacrifices, the animal sacrifices, because who's the sacrifice for sin now? It'd be Jesus, right? So you don't need that. But how about keeping the Sabbath? In fact, a Jew, his whole life had been told, keep the Sabbath. Keep it holy. Would it be wrong? Let me ask it this way. Would it be wrong if today, in this culture and world, if you decided, I'm going to keep the Sabbath. I'm going to set Saturdays aside, and I'm going to worship God on Saturdays. Would that be wrong if you chose to do that? He said, every Saturday, I'm going to worship God. Nothing wrong with it whatsoever. Now, you'd still have to take the Lord's Supper on Sunday, right? But if you said, I'm also going to keep the Sabbath. So he says, yeah, I'm not going to stop worshiping God on Sunday, the Lord's Day, but I'm still going to keep the Sabbath. Nothing wrong with that, is there? How about circumcising your children? Every Jew had been told from the beginning, when your child is born on the eighth day, you circumcise your sons. Is it a sin to circumcise? Absolutely not, in any way, shape, or form. In fact, Paul had Timothy circumcised so that he could be better capable of preaching to the Jews who would have been upset about something like that. So there were aspects of the law that Jewish Christians were still keeping, and they still valued. And they had been taught something about Paul. So here's all these Christians. They're still doing many of these things. And it says in verse 21, "But they have been informed about you, that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs." So now, whoever it was, they have been informed. This is how rumors always work, isn't it? They say. I don't know who they are, but they be saying things. They have been informed of this. The people have been told. The word on the street is. Paul's been out journeying and preaching, and they've been told that when Paul goes into a city, not only is he converting the Gentiles and converting the Jews, and he's telling the Gentiles, you don't need to obey Moses, but he's actually telling the Jews, you can't obey Moses, and you better forsake everything. Do not circumcise your children. Do not keep the Sabbath. Now, had Paul been saying that? He hadn't been saying that at all. But the word is, right? The gossip is, the reputation is. Paul's been away and he's not been able to defend himself. This is what they're being told, is that Paul is a Jew hater. He is doing everything to tear down Moses. Now, realistically, that's a valid worry. Because what would you and I feel about if somebody came in and they started telling us that Moses was a worthless guy? How would you feel if somebody started saying that? Don't ever listen. Moses never said anything worthwhile ever. Would you have a problem with a sermon like that? I would. Moses said a great deal of things. Moses was a servant of God. You don't take that lightly. Well, they were having the view, they were being told that Paul was essentially doing that. Being a Jew is a horrible thing. Don't ever listen to anything Moses said. And telling Jews to forsake anything in their heritage. So here Paul comes into town, and the elders in the congregation are worried because of this reputation. So in verse 22, it says, "What then? The assembly must certainly meet, for they will hear that you have come. Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified with them, and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads, that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law." Now, in the Old Testament, there was a... God said in, let me look at my notes here, Numbers 6. In Numbers chapter 6 and verse 2 through 12, you can read through there where there was a protocol for keeping a vow. If you made a vow to God, you made the vow, you go to the temple, you'd make the vow, and then after a certain amount of days, whenever the vow was completed, then you'd go and you would pay your dues of the vow, you'd shave your head, and that was the Jewish protocol for keeping a vow. Now, it would be weird, but if tomorrow somebody said, "I am making a vow to God, and at the end of the 30 days, I'm going to read my Bible, I'm going to read five chapters of my Bible every day for 30 days. I make a vow to God. And at the end of that vow, I'm going to shave my head." Now, would that be weird if somebody told you that? It would most certainly be weird, but would it be wrong? Kyle over there, he says, after 30 days of reading my Bible, I'm going to shave my head. He'd be weird, but it wouldn't be wrong, would it? Lots of things that are weird that aren't wrong. And so here are these men. They're Jewish Christians. They have made some sort of vow, and the time of them completing their vow is about at hand. So they're going to do what every Jew has always done whenever they kept a vow to God. They're going to go to the temple. They're going to pay the dues and shave their head. So now Paul... What we want you to do is we want you to cover their expenses. Because in covering their expenses, you're going to show you don't have a problem with anybody who wants to live as a Jewish Christian. Does that make sense? In other words, he's just showing that he's okay with it. And, of course, Paul is okay with it, as we've already talked about. In fact, you can look over in 1 Corinthians and what Paul says about preaching the gospel. If you turn to 1 Corinthians, And you look over in chapter 9, down in verse 20, Paul says, in fact, let's start in verse 19. Paul says, "Though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law," that would be the Gentiles, the Jews are the ones under the law, the Gentiles are without it, "as without law, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." Paul's attitude was simply this: if you go into a Jewish culture and they ask you to do something that is not contradictory to the Bible, right? You're not asking them to do something that's contradicting Christianity. Can you do it? Yes. And in fact, you should, because if you... I remember Dan May went to China and went preaching. And he said, "Whenever I went to China, whatever food they put in front of me, I just ate it. And I ate with chopsticks." And he says, "I did it because of this. I became all things to all men." Because if you come in and you're going to preach to people from China and you eat with a fork, and he told this story actually about a preacher who went with him one time, and they made the restaurant go and hunt down a fork for the guy. And they spent, you know, 40 minutes, the owners of the restaurant, searching for a fork for this American preacher. How do you think those restaurant owners felt about that guy? They think, "Boy, this is a guy that gets us." No, there's a separation there. And so in the case of Paul, that's what Paul is doing, is he's saying, in whatever culture you're in, you want to match that. And so Paul says, so they're going to ask Paul to do this, and then what we'll find is that that will lead Paul to the temple. And I've not done this at all with this class, but I was afraid that this might happen with this class because there's almost two sections to this chapter. What we'll do is we'll cut this chapter right here and we'll make up time next week. And I don't think that there will be any problem doing that because the second half will go actually pretty quickly and tie in with chapter 22. But Paul will make this arrangement with these people to go to the temple, and from there, everything's going to begin to set in motion for actually Paul being thrown in prison. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, then we'll stop there and we'll pick up next week.